This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning around Australia. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. On today's program, a win on the world stage. The federal government gets its way for an international probe into the coronavirus pandemic. And border bans. Fears the domestic tourism industry could be hit hard if some state borders remain shut.
Most of our customers are Victorian and New South Welshmen. Yeah, and they're all repeat customers and they're all ready to come. They're just waiting on the border to open.
China has followed through on its threat to whack crippling tariffs on Australian barley, a move that will further inflame tensions between the two nations. The 80% tariff will be in place for 5 years, a decision that could cost Australian farmers hundreds of millions of dollars. The Trade Minister Simon Birmingham has told RN Breakfast his Chinese counterpart still has not spoken to him about the decision.
Australia does not believe that the decision China's made is justified or defensible in accordance with anti-dumping practices. And we're reserving all our rights. We will go over with the farming sector and barley exporters all of the detail of this decision, and we'll work out the best pathway forward as to whether that is a World Trade Organization appeal, how we continue to make representations to China.
There'll now be a scramble to find other markets, although Australia's largest barley exporter concedes China won't be easily replaced. Bridget Fitzgerald reports.
Even before China confirmed the barley tariff, the news it was considering such a move saw the grain price take an immediate hit.
The price dropped around $50 the day that the announcement came out about the tariff, which is about a 16 or 17% price drop in the one day. That puts it in unprofitable territory.
Mick Fells farms at Esperance on Western Australia's south coast. He's also the grain section president for the lobby group WA Farmers. WA is responsible for more than 80% of all Australian barley exports, and China is the largest customer. The import tax doesn't prevent Australia from selling barley, but it will likely have the effect of making the product so expensive in China that it won't be viable.
By the sleight of hand, a signature on a piece of paper, the Chinese will be deciding that they won't be able to afford our barley, which is a shame because they love our barley as much as we love selling it to them.
China's Ministry of Commerce claims Australian barley has been subsidised by the federal government and sold at a low price, which undermines local producers, something the government and farmers vehemently deny. Jason Craig is the Chief Marketing and Trading Officer for Australia's largest barley exporter, the CBH Group.
China has been our most important malting barley market for probably more than 40 years. We estimate the loss to the Australian growers of approximately $500 million.
China denies the barley tariff is related to Australia's push for an international investigation into the COVID-19 pandemic. But in recent days, the federal trade and agriculture ministers haven't been able to get their Chinese counterparts to return their phone calls. Barley is used for animal feed, but it's malting barley used in beer that's worth the most. Jason Craig again.
Total capacity outside of China in markets that Australia can access is about 3.7 million tonnes of total malting capacity. This is compares to about 5.4 million tonnes of capacity in China. So the rest of the market is only about 60% of the total capacity of China. Clearly, they're not going to be able to take up the sort of tonnage in the malting business that we've seen China over these number of years.
He says Australian barley production will need to be reassessed.
You may see some changes to growers' production and they may change back to wheat and other products, but we will continue to look at markets in the malting business anyway, including markets like India, for example, which is about 10% of the malting capacity of China. So we are looking at new markets and we will continue to do that, as well as our existing markets like Japan, Vietnam, Thailand, and of course domestically here in Australia.
In a statement, Grain Trade Australia says claims of illegal dumping of barley are unsubstantiated and it was deeply disappointed with China's decision.
Bridget Fitzgerald reporting there. China says it will support a review into the global handling of the coronavirus pandemic. But President Xi Jinping has told the World Health Assembly any investigation should wait until after the virus is under control. Australia's been leading the push for an independent probe, and the Health Minister, Greg Hunt, told the meeting that wildlife wet markets should be in the spotlight. From London, Nick Doll reports.
Never has a meeting of the World Health Organization's governing body been more closely watched. But rarely has so much been at stake. Via video conference, China's President Xi Jinping went on the defence. He said his country had been open and transparent when the coronavirus broke out in Wuhan, and it made many sacrifices to save lives.
We've provided the information to the WHO and relevant countries in a most timely fashion. We've released the genome sequence at the earliest possible time. We've shared control and treatment experience. We've done everything in our power to support and assist countries in need.
But the US Health Secretary Alex Azar took clear aim at China, accusing it of a cover-up. He didn't actually name names, but there were no prizes for guessing who he was referring to.
In an apparent attempt to conceal this outbreak, at least one member state made a mockery of their transparency obligations, with tremendous cost for the entire world.
China says it will back a WHO-led investigation, but it says that should only begin once the virus has been contained. The WHO says an independent review will be established as soon as possible. But exactly when it'll begin, who'll conduct it, and what access it'll be given remain open questions. Andrew Small is a non-resident fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. He says China's anticipated the growing international support for an inquiry.
I think that a degree of pressure on too many fronts had really built for them to be for the Chinese side to be able to evade anything resembling an inquiry at all. I think they kind of changed tactics at a certain point to trying to figure out the best way to manage an inquiry in a way that will be least intrusive and problematic from their perspective.
Australia is among the nations who've been leading calls for an independent international probe. Health Minister Greg Hunt told delegates the investigation needs to look at the potential sources, but also the WHO's powers.
This could include an examination of whether the WHO's mandate and powers, including around inspection, need to be strengthened to ensure WHO members have timely access to critical data. And we need to protect against the global health threat posed by wildlife wet markets.
Most nations spoke in support of the WHO's work. The United States was far less generous, accusing it of an outright failure that cost many lives. This is Nick Doll in London reporting for AM.
Parents may soon need to rebalance the family budget, with the federal government signalling its free childcare policy may be coming to an end. Today, the Education Department will release a review of the policy, which is due to run until June the 28th. While it highlights some flaws, it credits Education Minister Dan Tehan's intervention with saving the sector, but he warns the free ride may not go on for much longer. National Education and Parenting reporter Connor Duffy reports.
After midnight meetings at the height of the pandemic, Minister Tehan announced 3 months of free childcare, starting on April the 2nd. 6 weeks in, an Education Department report to be released today finds it's largely fulfilled its aim of rescuing a sector on the brink of collapse.
It is rewarding when you see that a lot of hard work has paid dividends.
But that doesn't mean it'll continue beyond the three-month deadline of June 28. The report, based on a survey of 7,000 providers, has found that childcare capacity is at just 63%. The minister wants it at 100%.
Repairing the budget and repairing our economy are going to be crucial going forward. So we have to take all these things into consideration when we make decisions around the future of the childcare package.
The Education Department's report isn't all praise. It notes that while most mainstream childcare centres were able to stay open and keep their staff, those running family daycare at an educator's house or at a family's own home faced a long wait for government payments.
No other frontline essential worker who they can't self-distance changing a nappy and was asked to not get their normal pay.
Kylie Burnett from the Northern Rivers Children's Service in Lismore, which operates family daycare and in-home care, says the report's criticism is spot on.
Frontline workers just being asked to open so that other people can go to work and to accept less pay is just, it's so devaluing.
Minister Tehan is considering extra help for in-home care, but is also considering a return to the pre-pandemic Commonwealth Childcare Subsidy, or CCS, where parents were paid a rebate on a sliding scale based on their income.
Well, the old system included parents making a contribution, so that's something obviously that we will seriously consider. It was putting downward pressure on prices.
At the time free childcare was announced, pundits warned there could be electoral pain if it was later withdrawn. Samantha Page, the CEO of Early Childhood Australia, says a return to the CCS too soon could undo all the good work.
The other reason we wanted another 3 months of the relief package is we don't know whether there's going to be a second wave or a third wave.
The government has pledged to announce changes 4 weeks before the scheme is due to end on June 28.
Connor Duffy reporting there. How soon is too soon to reopen Australia's internal borders? State and territory leaders are at odds over the issue. New South Wales Premier Gladys Berejiklian is keen to see the border to Queensland open again ASAP, but that state's Premier Anastasia Palaszczuk says such a move could be months away. Her comments have been met with despair by some tourism operators in that state. Barbara Miller reports.
It's that time of year when normally the grey nomads are embarking on the great migration north.
Most of our customers are Victorian and New South Welshmen. Yeah, and they're all repeat customers and they're all ready to come. They're just waiting on the border to open, but if it doesn't open, they won't be here this year and we'll be basically empty, I guess.
Rob Handel runs the Wonga Beach Caravan Park north of Port Douglas. He's torn about news that the state border could be closed for months yet.
On a personal note, probably that would be right, but on a business note, it's going to hurt us immensely.
Premier Anastasia Palaszczuk says the reopening of the border will be reviewed monthly.
It should be better to have a date, so you can turn an airline on, you can plan a flight. You can't just start up overnight.
Steve Edmondson is the owner of Sail Away Reef and Island Tours in Port Douglas.
We're very disappointed that they take a choice to review it after 4 weeks when effectively we will miss out all of that high season. Absolutely stunned and devastated.
Steve Edmondson says intrastate tourism can't possibly make up for lost business.
That's a nice idea, and we would love to see our Queenslanders. However, being such a beautiful state, relatively low population, there's just not enough Queenslanders to keep the tourism industry going.
LNP MP Warren Ench, whose Leichhardt electorate takes in Cairns and Port Douglas, says for now he backs the Premier's call.
I've got to say that she's done a pretty good job in managing this situation. And, you know, I'm not going to go out there and attack her because of the politics.
Well, given we've got so few new cases in each of the states, do we need to speed up the reopening within and between states?
Look, you're right, but why have we got so few cases? We've got so few cases because we've followed strict medical advice and we've been very, very disciplined in the way we managed it. Suddenly we open it up, we end up like bloody Brazil. Or the US, for that matter.
The WA Premier, Mark McGowan, has also indicated he's in no hurry to reopen the state's border. That's bitter news for Jeff Hard, who runs Cellar Door Winery Tours in the Margaret River region.
We have not had income for 2 going on 3 months. Not a zack. Nothing.
The Federal Tourism Minister, Simon Birmingham, is urging the states to move sooner. In a statement to AM, Simon Birmingham said, if the successful suppression of COVID-19 continues, then the states should be relaxing their border controls. If one or two states were to hold out, the statement continues, then they will be answerable to their tourism industry and will ultimately need to provide additional support to that industry. With the debate over schools now largely put to rest, the issue of state borders is emerging as the next flashpoint between governments.
Barbara Miller reporting there. You're listening to AM and it's 14 minutes past 8. Allegations of war crimes committed by Australian soldiers in Afghanistan will be pursued by a top lawyer who was also once deployed to the troubled nation. David McClure has been appointed by the Commonwealth Director of Public Prosecutions to take on the sensitive cases. Our defence correspondent is Andrew Green. Andrew, good morning. Tell us a little bit more about David McClure and his new role.
David McClure is considered a rising star, Sabra, in the legal fraternity. And back in 2008, he deployed to Afghanistan, where he actually worked with the Special Operations Task Group. Now, since then, he's defended commandos, Australian commandos, that have been charged with manslaughter in Afghanistan. And he's also come to some prominence recently when he represented the operators of the Ruby Princess cruise ship. Well, now we've learned that in just recent weeks, the Commonwealth DPP has drafted him as an external prosecutor for possible cases of war crimes involving Australian Special Forces soldiers that may be charged soon for their conduct in Afghanistan. Now, for the part of the Commonwealth DPP, it's not saying anything at this stage, and AM has also approached the Defence Minister, Linda Reynolds, who's declined to comment on this Top Silks appointment.
So this appointment, is it a signal that the long-running defence inquiry examining the conduct of Australia's Special Forces in Afghanistan is about to wrap up?
There's certainly a feeling within defence circles that things are moving pretty quickly, and federal police sources say that their own investigations have uncovered a substantial amount of evidence ahead of possibly laying charges. The inquiry that you mentioned, well, that's being run by the Inspector General of the ADF, and we know that since 2016, it's been closely examining rumours and allegations that Australian troops killed unarmed Afghan men and children. Back in February, the Inspector General, in its annual report, revealed that the process was in its final stages and that it was examining 55 separate incidents of alleged breaches of the rules of war during that lengthy Afghanistan conflict.
That's our defence correspondent, Andrew Green. The federal government's revealed major changes to its controversial $2 billion Climate Solutions Fund, which is the old rebadged Emissions Reduction Fund, and it will allow taxpayer dollars to be used to subsidise carbon capture and storage projects. It follows a review commissioned last year and headed up by the former Business Council and energy boss, Grant King. That review also recommends that companies that reduce their carbon emissions below the so-called safeguard mechanism be given credits for it, which can then be traded. But the government denies it's a form of carbon trading. The Energy and Emissions Reduction Minister is Angus Taylor. Minister, good morning and welcome to AM.
Thanks for having me, Sabra.
First, the report talks about the need for net zero emissions by 2050. To be clear, is that now explicitly the government's policy?
No. The Paris Agreement, of course, agrees that all countries who are party to the agreement should collectively reach net zero in the second half of the century. That, of course, is the government's policy. But more importantly, Sabra, our approach to this is to not have a target without a plan. Our focus is on using technology, not taxes, to get to outcomes. And obviously, as technologies improve, we expect significant emissions reductions, and we'd love to be able to achieve net zero by 2050. But ultimately, that will depend on the pathways of technologies to deliver that without damaging the economy.
Okay, the review recommends the broadening of the eligibility of the Climate Solutions Fund to include carbon capture and storage, a system that captures emissions and stores them underground. How will you convince Parliament to pass that, as the Senate probably is not going to support it?
Well, this is a change in the methodology. You know, it's not a change in the underlying legislation necessarily, Sabra. But the important point here is that we have to use every possible means we can, every possible technology to reduce emissions. Now, when you look at carbon capture and storage, it's now widely accepted by the IPCC, the IEA. So we expect it to be a very important part of the global effort, and it's certainly relevant in Australia.
There is deep scepticism about its ability to work, but to be clear, you don't need Parliament's approval. Is that what you're now saying?
Well, I mean, it depends how we do it, but what this is proposed to do is change the methodology. That's very different from many of the debates that have happened in the past. So we're proposing on having a methodology which allows carbon capture and storage to be included in the Climate Solutions Fund. That work is already underway. And as I say, this is not new. The oil industry has been using this for various means for many, many years. It's well understood. It's now widely accepted. The IEA itself has accepted it as an important part of the technology toolkit. We store carbon now in vegetation, in soil. We can store it in geological areas as well.
Now, I'm going to put this in a very simple way because it's very complex. The report recommends using the safeguard mechanism that sets the limit for emissions and allow a so-called below baseline crediting mechanism, rewarding companies that cut emissions below that level, giving them credit for that, which then can be traded. Is that not a form of voluntary carbon trading?
No, I mean, this is simply saying, and look, if you take a step back and keep it simple, as you rightly say, we need to as we work our way through these things. This is just about making sure that Australian manufacturing has the right incentives in place to reduce emissions. So there is a safeguard mechanism. It penalises manufacturers if they raise their emissions in a way that's out of line with that mechanism. That's already in existence. But there's no incentive, there's no carrot, if you like,
sure,
for them to go further than that. This simply provides a carrot for them to be able to reduce their emissions beyond that baseline. And what that does that's so important is it gives them an incentive to deploy new technologies. And that's what we want to see.
That's right, but it gives companies a reward if they cut emissions below that certain threshold, and it's suggested that they be allowed to trade that. That is a form of carbon trading, is it not?
Use now. There's nothing new with that. That's a pre-existing system that we have through the Emissions Reduction Funds. What is new here is that we're saying if you are a manufacturer and you can deploy the very best technology available to get your emissions per unit of output, whatever it is you're producing, to a very low level, you should receive some reward for that, some credit for that under the
Climate Solutions Fund.
So, I beg your pardon?
That then can be traded for money.
Well, they can use it for many different purposes. They can use it for another part of their business. They can trade it. They can trade it now. I mean, look, if a farmer reduces emissions or absorbs emissions in their vegetation or their soil, they can trade now. That's exactly what happens. So there's absolutely nothing new in that. The certificates are well understood. They're called ACCUs. And they're tradable. So that is not the new thing here. The new thing is encouraging manufacturers to deploy best practice technology. And coming out of COVID-19, encouraging our manufacturing sector to invest, to deploy the very best technologies available, that's something we all want to achieve.
This decision preempts a review into the Emissions Reduction Fund by the Climate Change Authority. Submissions to that review close tomorrow. Why aren't you waiting to hear what the authority has to say before redesigning this policy?
Well, we'll be interested in what they've got to say, but I mean, we're getting on with it. I commissioned this back in October last year. We committed to the Climate Solutions Fund $2 billion at the beginning of last year, and we want to get moving because the faster we get moving, the faster we get these new technologies into place. We broaden the Emissions Reduction Fund into the Climate Solutions Fund, which will include a strong focus on manufacturing, on agriculture, on transport, on these sectors that haven't been a focus in the past. There's no time to wait. This is important work that we must get on with. I welcome any further input, and there'll be lots of consultation on the implementation of these recommendations over the coming months, including with the Climate Change Authority.
Minister, thanks for joining AM this morning.
Thanks for having me, Sabra.
That's the Energy and Emissions Reduction Minister, Angus Taylor. Mega bushfires are making the logging of native forests unviable, according to new research from the Australian National University. Ecologists have found many of the forests slated for harvesting won't mature enough because they're being wiped out by fire. Samantha Donovan reports.
David Lindenmayer is a professor of ecology at the Australian National University. He says the number of megafires in the Victorian landscape is increasing, and they're more likely to happen in state forest rather than national parks.
Victoria has had one megafire before the year 2000, but three since 2003. The extent of fire in the production forest is just gobsmacking. 63% of all the wood production forests in Victoria burnt in the last 25 years. It's just phenomenal. What is actually happening is that fire is competing with logging for forest, and fire is winning.
And Professor Lindenmayer says the frequency of bushfires means trees aren't getting mature enough for harvesting.
80% of forest will be burnt before it reaches 80 years old and becomes a saw log.
Native timber logging is to be phased out in Victoria by 2030. So will that solve this issue, as you said?
It's a very good move from the Victorian government. But the reality here is that in the last fire season, 2019-2020, 59% of everything in the East Gippsland region and almost 30% statewide was burnt. So we're not going to have enough resource to push us out to 2030. We're going to have to do it earlier than that. And we're going to have to look at investments and work packages to help make these diversifications in regional Australia.
And how do you think those transitions should be made?
So we already know that logging contractors are the most skilled heavy machinery operators. So we need to be able to develop those people further to be elite firefighting crews. But we also need to be looking at other investments in infrastructure in regional Australia, including in the domestic tourism industry.
Professor Lindenmayer's research is being published today in the Journal of the National Academy of Sciences in the US. Vic Forests is the state-owned business which harvests timber from Victoria's state forests. It's told AM that many academics and fire experts agree that harvesting doesn't elevate fire risk and that it works with partner agencies and uses scientific research to develop a harvest program that protects the environment and mitigates the impacts of bushfires. Vic Forests says it's proud that its ecologically sensitive approach supports regional communities that have been affected by bushfires. And it points to a report from Deloitte Access Economics, which found that Vic Forests, its customers and contractors, generated $770 million in revenue during 2015-16 and supported over 2,500 jobs.
Samantha Donovan reporting there. While we've all been focused on COVID-19, the Great Barrier Reef has had a devastating few months with its most extensive coral bleaching event ever recorded. But on today's episode of The Signal, find out why there's still hope for our natural wonder of the world, thanks to a particularly hardy coral in the Red Sea. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts or on the ABC Listen app. You may have heard on AM last week, women have been hit particularly hard by COVID-19 related job losses. But now a new report is highlighting that it isn't just women in the workforce bearing the brunt. From the loss of social networks to increased rates of domestic violence and a lack of access to education, girls and young women are feeling the strain of the pandemic. Social affairs correspondent Norman Hermont reports.
For nearly 2 months, this is how 16-year-old Mayela Daye has been catching up with friends online.
Have you been watching in English or in Spanish? Do you want decaf or cinnamon? Cinnamon, please.
Coffee and get-togethers are limited to her family in Sydney. Losing face-to-face contact has definitely impacted her social network.
I can see the mental health effect that has on a lot of girls. I've seen a lot of girls try to overcompensate with the loss of physical networking, trying to call as many people as possible to try and bridge that gap.
Loss of support through social networks is just one of the ways COVID-19 is having a greater impact on girls and young women than men, according to a new report from the humanitarian organization Plan International. Suzanne Legina is the CEO of the NGO's Australian arm.
Without doubt, in emergencies, the most vulnerable suffer the most. And invariably that means women and girls by virtue of their age and their gender.
There have been dramatic increases in domestic violence. Professor Kathy Humphreys from the University of Melbourne says advocates monitoring the situation have reported 6 fatal acts of violence against women in the last 2 weeks, twice the average death rate.
Isolation is so dangerous. We know that the more isolated a woman is when she's living with domestic violence, the more vulnerable she is.
Internationally, the plan report looked at other serious issues, including access to education. 19-year-old Leila Yacoubi is a nursing student in Melbourne and a former asylum seeker. She's in regular contact with friends from her childhood in Pakistan.
That's something that me and my friends talked about, is that whether they can continue their education after this pandemic. They're really affected by this. Now that their parents are not working anymore, they cannot longer go to school and pay their fees. And most of these girls won't go back to school.
Plan International Suzanne Legina says as the world emerges from this pandemic, it has one big advantage when it comes to providing more equality for girls and women.
We have the lessons from previous crises to help guide us. Let's think about what can we do in this time that will set it up on the other side for a more equal, fairer, better society as well.
That's Plan International's Suzanne Legina ending Norman Hermont's report. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Stephen Smiley.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. The Great Barrier Reef has been experiencing its most widespread coral bleaching event on record. But could a species of obscure coral that seems to be thriving despite warmer water help?
Today on The Signal, we look at the science of coral bleaching and ask whether there's still time to save the reef from destruction. Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.